Today, we have two very special guests on our program, introducing Lem and Lime.
Hello.
For Starry Lemon Lime Soda.
Thanks for having us.
What is Starry Lemon Lime Soda?
It's a crisp, clear burst of lemon lime flavor, and it's caffeine-free.
Between us, one of you must be a little more important to Starry than the other. Who is it?
We're both important.
So we could just as easily be Starry Lime Lemon Soda.
No, that doesn't sound right.
Oh, I like it.
So you saying hip-hop could be hop-hip?
Works for me.
Starry Lemon Lime Soda. Starry hits different.
Talking history. This is News Talk.
We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender.
And out of that silence came thousands of voices.
The strategy of the white man has always been divide and conquer.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Auchteroin, Argus, Akoiza.
Well, good evening, history lovers, and welcome to News Talk's Talkin' History. It's Tommy Graham of History Ireland in the chair. Now, this evening, we're coming to you live. I said we're coming to you live. That's more like it. From the benches of the Supreme Court in Dublin's Four Courts as part of Dublin City Council's Bram Stoker Festival. Now, why the legal setting? Well, this evening we'll be focusing not on Stoker's famous and much-adapted work of fiction, Dracula, but on his second work of non-fiction, The Duties of Clerks of Petty Sessions in Ireland. Now, what were the Petty Sessions and what can they tell us about the Ireland of Bram Stoker's time and indeed about the author himself? Now, to address these and related questions, I'm joined by, on my left, Judge Paul Kelly, President of the District Court. On my right, Professor Jarla Killeen, Trinity College Dublin. And finally, on the far left, Zoe Reid, Keeper at the National Archives of Ireland. Now, Jarla, could I start with you? Who was Bram Stoker? Just give us a quick run through.
So Bram was the son of Charlotte Blake Thornley, who was a hard-nosed, tough-minded Sligo woman. Probably tough-minded because she survived a cholera epidemic in 1832, and the son of Abraham Stoker Sr., who was a civil servant in the Chief Secretary of Ireland's office in Dublin Castle. The Chief Secretary of Ireland was essentially the British government's minister for Ireland. So it was a fairly important office that Abraham Stoker Sr. was working in. Bram was the third child of this marriage. They were a solidly middle-class Dublin family, Protestant family. He was born in 1847, the worst year of the famine. And he tells us that he was extremely sick for the first 7 years of his life, didn't walk, he claims, until he was seven. But he seems to have recovered fairly well by the time he entered Trinity College in 1864, where he was an undergraduate studying what was called the ordinary course at the time. It was essentially kind of an arts course with a bit of maths. Greek, Latin. But in 1866, 2 years after he started in Trinity, he entered the civil service as a clerk in the office of the Courts of Petty Sessions. But he was still an undergraduate student, so he remained an undergraduate student at Trinity until he graduated in 1870. All that time, he was also working full-time, 6.5 days a week, in Dublin Castle as a civil servant. And he was also extraordinarily our theatre reviewer in the evenings. He was writing fiction. He was involved in enormous numbers of sporting activities. He was a major member of Dublin's social scene. He was the auditor of the HIST and the president of the FILD. This was even after he graduated. So he was a man involved in enormous numbers of activities in Victorian Dublin.
He sounds like the kind of guy who didn't let his job interfere with his work.
No, you have to wonder whether, while he was in Dublin Castle, was he sneaking in some of the things he was meant to be doing elsewhere? So was he doing his review writing while he was also in the office of the Courts of Petty Sessions? But he was quite diligent in the office because he was very quickly promoted. He starts off as a junior on a salary, I think it was £180 with an annual increment of £10 a year. And he's very quickly, and it's an office of around 8, he very quickly is promoted. He's given control of that office to a certain extent, and then a new post is invented. This is the court of the inspector of the courts of petty sessions at a slightly increased salary of £250 a year with increments of £12 every year, and he gets that job, and that is on a higher salary than his dad had for most of the time he was in the civil service.
Okay, so and how did he end up writing this particular, you know, this thing on the petty sessions? Why was he picked out?
That's unclear whether he was asked to do it by the registrar, and that's certainly possible. He might have noticed that this was extremely enterprising, very almost a workaholic, with a very broad administrative mind. He had a great ability to kind of condense information very quickly. So maybe he spotted this, or Stoker might have suggested to him, we need something. We need some kind of manual for the clerks of the courts of petty sessions. And he went about deciding, I'm going to cut all this administrative tape. I'm going to collate all the material that's necessary in one place for everyone to consult. And that's the kind of thing he liked doing. He was an extremely efficient bureaucrat.
So he had an organized mind.
Yes. As far as I'm concerned, Stoker is first and foremost a bureaucrat and an administrator, and a reforming bureaucrat and administrator. That's where he was at his best.
Now, just before I bring the others in, just a few quick words. I mean, you describe him as middle class, but the family did have sort of lower gentry connections, did they not?
They had small, but certainly you find sometimes people writing that he was a member of the Anglo-Irish. They didn't have land. They didn't have any real connections to the landed aristocracy at all. They were middle class. They were professionals. They were people who worked for a living every single day and worked very hard.
And how would you describe his politics?
He was a nationalist, which was unlike his family. It was just very different. So he grew up in what he calls a very conservative household with unionist politics, but he was an Irish nationalist, and he was profoundly influenced by Gladstone, the British Prime Minister, who supported Home Rule, and that's where his politics differed from his family, and that took some courage, I think, in Dublin in the Victorian period.
And it kind of puts the lie on this idea that you restrict division on the basis of religion in terms of politics.
Like, well, absolutely. I mean, who the leaders of the Home Rule movement were Irish Protestants anyway. I think about Isaac Butt was the person who established the Home Rule Party, and then Charles Stewart Parnell was an Irish landlord.
Now, having said that, though, he did very much see himself as part of the British metropole.
Yes, so that, he sees this work that he's doing, this book, this compilation, as aiding the administration, the more efficient administration of the British Empire. He talks about it in the book as this is going to help the empire work more efficiently because it's too much red tape.
Now, I want to bring in Judge Kelly, who's given me a dispensation calling Paul from here on in. Thank you, Paul. Paul, just could you just give us some background here, because there's some huge changes taking place in the legal system in the mid-19th century. Could you just give us an idea of what's happening?
Yeah, well, I suppose the subject of today's talk, the Petty Sessions Courts, came about as a result of the Petty Sessions Ireland Act, which was introduced in 1851. And that was a consolidation of a series of laws regulating the work of the courts and the justices of the peace in Ireland. And it marked the start of a period of introduction of new laws in Ireland. You had DC's Act in 1860, which changed the feudal system of tenancies and rents. And then that in turn led on to the various land acts of the 1880s. So the Petty Sessions Ireland Act, it was actually ahead of its time, because it took until 1864 before England decided to consolidate their various Petty Sessions Acts. I think Scotland and Wales did it in the early 1860s. So Ireland was probably one of the first major consolidations of a legal system. And the Petty Sessions Courts were established as a result of the 1851 Act. And in effect, they were the precursor to the modern district court. They were the court that most people came in contact with if they had any grievances or accused of offences, if they want to recover debts or whatever. So very like today's district court, it was the lowest level jurisdiction and the one that had the most impact on the ordinary lives of everyday people. And we'll probably be talking later on about some of the cases that showed how much of an impact it had on people's lives.
So what you're saying is that the courts are coming more into the day-to-day lives of ordinary people.
I would think so, yeah. Yeah. As more and more laws were being passed, and I often make the observation even today that the Oireachtas is up in Kildare Street passing laws every day of the week, creating new offences and new legal challenges. And there's more and more law, therefore more and more need for courts. And the same was happening in Ireland from the 1850s onwards.
But basically what you're saying is it's a move from kind of customary rights to more yes. hard legal
yes, indeed.
Rights.
Indeed,
right.
Yeah.
And of course that could be a double-edged sword, because that could be to the advantage of the say, the tenant farm or whatever,
yeah.
in relations with landlords and so forth.
That's right. That's
yeah.
right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, Zoe, what were the petty sessions? I mean, what are we talking about here? And in particular, who are the clerks?
So the petty sessions, as Paul sort of said, were the lowest denomination of the court. So they were really, and slightly the clues in the name. We use the term today, petty, for small and minor things and minor grievances with each other. And that's exactly what you would have seen within the courts of the petty sessions. You would have seen things of people, you know, drunkenness, assault, traffic offences, trespassing, cruelty to animals. Farmers came up in front of the courts every so often about wandering animals. That seemed to cause a lot of distress to people. But, you know, horses and pigs wandering. And when you think about it, well, cattle can cause destruction to other people's property. Begging would have come up in front of it. Farmers not having the names on their carts. As they went about their business, that would have come up. So a wide variety of minor things. The cases were dealt with quickly. There wasn't a jury. There was, as Paul said, the justice of the peace. He would have listened to the complainants and the defendants, and then would have adjudicated. Normally fines. Small fines were given to people between 1 and 10 shillings, maybe sometime in jail, but normally it was fines.
Who were the JPs, the Justices of the Peace?
So the Justice of the Peace, it was an unpaid position, so it tended to be gentlemen who had land, so the landed gentry as such, so people who could afford to give their time to the courts. And the courts, now, and we see this with Stoker's book, The Duties of the Clerk of the Petty Sessions, there were hundreds of courts all around the country. Yesterday I went into the archives, I was doing a bit of rummaging through the collection that Jarlath mentioned, the Chief Secretary's office, that their registered papers, just to get an idea of what might be in there. And I was looking at some material from 1876, and it was I came across a publication where the courts were expanding in counties Antrim and Down, and they had to provide that back into the chief, the undersecretary in Dublin Castle, to tell him how many courts there were going to be. And there were hundreds of courts going on all around the country all the time. And I found another letter where a clerk from County Mayo, from Newport County Mayo, was writing in to ask for permission to change the court day from the Tuesday to the Friday. And so all that legal administration stuff is held, sort of the background, not the court cases as such, but how they administered, is held within the Chief Secretary's office.
Just going back to the JPs, I mean, if they're local landowners, right? Mm. I mean, is not our problem straight away, because my point is, this isn't England. In England, there's going to be a certain social deference to the local landlord. But that's not necessarily the case in Ireland, right? Particularly in the wake of, say, the 1798 rebellion and the various other rebellions that happened during this period.
In terms of that, I actually don't. I don't know what the attitude of the
Paul.
What's
your comment on that?
I suppose there were justices of the peace, but there were also resident magistrates. And your older listeners may well recall the Somerville and Ross stories about the Irish RM, which was the subject of a very, very good TV series in the early 1980s. And Major Yates, the Irish RM in that collection, was an Englishman who came over to a remote part of County Kerry to be the resident magistrate. And I think they were tolerated once they were doing a reasonably decent job, and they just got on with it. In many cases, if there were local landlords who were absentee landlords, they didn't tend to end up as the justices of the peace or the resident magistrates. So I think they were largely part and parcel of Irish country life at the time, and tolerated to that extent.
So they're more hands-on type landlords.
More hands-on,
yeah.
There were 604 petty sessions courts in Ireland at the time that Bram Stoker wrote his page-turner of a guide to the petty sessions. So it was a busy...
That's one of the reasons why he writes the book. He's concerned that in each of these individual courts, the clerks and the justices of the peace are just allowed to do whatever and adapt themselves to however it's done in that area. And he's very clear in the book, there needs to be a uniformity. There needs to be some kind of a consistency in the behaviour of the clerks and the behaviour of the justices of the peace and also the administration of justice. Because if it's not administered consistently and clearly, then people will lose faith in how justice is administered. And that's one of the things that he's trying to do with his book. And also, remember, this is at the time where he's travelling around all over Ireland, looking at these courts, seeing how they're in operation, and he's becoming very, very frustrated with the sheer ad hoc nature of a lot of them. In one of his first books of fiction that's set in Ireland, called The Snake's Pass, he has a long passage in it. It's clearly written by a bureaucrat in a civil service saying, I hate the way every part of Ireland thinks it can do things whatever way they used to do it in the past. We have to have consistency. We have to cut through all this nonsense.
So it's part of that Victorian obsession with imposing rationality on an irrational world.
It is certainly that. But he's also clear in the book. He says that clerks of petty sessions must deal with the public very carefully and gently, because in the petty sessions courts, this is where people are anxious and angry and bitter against their neighbours. So you have to, the clerk is supposed to be able to mediate clearly and not exacerbate the situation. So he talks about an urbane manner that the clerk has to adopt.
That's a good point to take an ad break, because I want to come back after the ads, back to Paul and Zoe, to look at particular cases. So back with you after the break, listeners.
Today we have two very special guests on our program, introducing Lem and Lime.
Hello!
For Starry Lemon Lime Soda.
Thanks for having us.
What is Starry Lemon Lime Soda?
It's a crisp, clear burst of lemon lime flavor, and it's caffeine-free.
Between us, one of you must be a little more important to Starry than the other. Who is it?
We're both important.
So we could just as easily be Starry Lime Lemon Soda.
No, that doesn't sound right.
Ooh, I like it.
So you saying hip-hop could be hop-hip?
Works for me.
Starry Lemon Lime Soda. Starry hits different.
Now, welcome back, listeners. Now, before the break, we were talking about the petty sessions. So, for this part now, I want to just look at some of the particular cases. Zoe, you made out a list of some interesting cases, and maybe, Paul, you can bring your professional background to bear on this as well. So, Zoe, just talk to us about what sort of things...
In terms of cases, if we kind of do the high numbers and the big numbers, which you can do because we've such a vast amount of records, essentially about one third of the cases were to do with drunk and disorderly. About 16% of the cases were to do with assault. About 5% were acts of local nuisance and about 4% destruction of property. So that kind of gives you an idea of kind of the colour as such within the cases. In terms of the acts of destruction caused by animals, there's a case that I was looking at. And I suppose to preface it in terms of cases, what you have in the order books where all the cases are documented, and this was the role of the clerk, they had these large registers, they had 15 columns of information to fill out that would have the name of the complainant, the name of the defence, who was spoken to, the complaint about that was being investigated, and then the judgment, and then it was signed off by the judge. And once it was signed off by the judge, then or the JP, then it was considered a legal recording of the case. So one from 1871 was James Brannan in the Petty Session Court of Westmeath. And the complaint against him was that his four pigs were wandering on the public road on the 19th of August in 1871. And only 3 days later, he was up in front of the Petty Session Court on the 22nd of August, and he was fined 2 shillings for that. As I say, the wandering animals, cruel treatment of animals, unfortunately, came up a lot. Again, normally... tied in with drunkenness. So ill-treating a donkey under the influence of alcohol, Michael Downey, poor Michael Downey of Athlone, Westmeath, and this is in the early 20th centuries in 1910. He was drunk while in charge of a cart and ass in a public area, but that was his fourth occasion to be up in front of the Petty Session Court in 1910 alone, and he was also there in 1908 and 1909. So he had a lot of frequency within the court, shall we say. But Paul was going through and looking. He has a great list of some of the cases that he found. I was trying to find females within the court cases, and that can be difficult. You can look by name, but you can't look at the records under the misdemeanors as such. But Paul, you had a great one about Charlotte.
Grace O'Brien. Yeah. Yes. Well, Charlotte Grace O'Brien was a social reformer and author, but she was also a daughter of the young Irelander, William Smith O'Brien. And she campaigned for better conditions for women emigrants travelling to America. And she applied to the Petty Sessions Court in Queenstown in 1882 for a licence to establish, to carry on the business of a passage broker. So that was an example of a woman before the courts, but not as a criminal defendant, which is probably quite similar today. But there are very many cases with some historical resonances. So you mentioned the issue of people not having their names on carts.
Yeah.
The Summary Jurisdiction Ireland Act of 1851, which is the same year as the Petty Sessions Act, one of its many provisions was that you had to have your name and address in legible letters, not less than an inch high, on the side of your cart, and significantly on the off side of your cart, in other words, the side nearest the road. The theory being that in days before there were registration numbers, if you were knocked down by a cart, you could find out who the owner was. So that was the theory of it. Now, as you can imagine, in Victorian Ireland in the late 19th century, significant numbers of people spoke Irish. So there's a case in 1905 where a man by the name of Neil McGill of Rieger, or Neil McBride, from Dunfanaghy in County Donegal, was prosecuted and fined in the Carndonagh Petty Sessions for having his name on his cart, Oscailge, and in the old Irish script. And one of the interesting things about that case is that his lawyers asked that a case be stated to the Court of King's Bench here in Dublin, because they said, well, his name is on the cart and it can be read, and it can be read by anybody in the locality who speaks Irish. And in the Court of King's Bench, his case was argued by Tim Healy, who later became a Governor General in the Irish Free State, but also by Padraig Pearce, who was a barrister and was in the early years of his practice at the bar. They were unfortunately unsuccessful because the court held that the fact that the letters were the old Irish script meant that they weren't legible in the meaning of the act. But that led on then to the following year, where a fellow called Donal O'Buachla, who was a shop owner in Maynooth, decided in an effort to get around this prohibition that he would put his name and address in Irish on his cart, but using ordinary English letters. So again, he was prosecuted, and again, Pearce brought the case to the Court of King's Bench. And this time, the same judge, Lord Justice Peter O'Brien, or Lord Chief Justice O'Brien, decided that even though the cases or the letters were legible, they had to be in English. And there was a big argument in the court about, you know, what if it was Turkish, what if it was Greek, you know.
Paul, can I just bring in Jared in this? Just going back to Stoker, did Stoker demonstrate any appreciation for the Irish language in his writings or in any way?
Well, what you find in it, he kept a diary all the time. No, would you call it a diary? It was some kind of journal. It was some kind of commonplace book, perhaps. But while he was traveling around, what he's interested in is not so much the Irish language, and he certainly never learned the Irish language, but he's certainly interested in the turns of phrases. And he records all kinds of turns of phrases, particular expressions, local expressions, but no real interest in the Irish language as such. Now and again, a few words, I think there's a couple of words in The Snake's Pass, which is one of his first novels, but certainly never went to the bother of learning the Irish language.
Yeah.
But he was interested in the way people spoke. He was fascinated by dialect and by accent. He's very interested in that.
Paul, sorry for interrupting.
No, I was just going to... that case had a number of other knock-on consequences. Those two cases led to the Chief Secretary's office in Dublin deciding that they weren't going to prosecute these cases because they were just too much trouble and they were making martyrs out of people. So a circular was issued from the Chief Secretary's office, which is where Stoker would have been working, to apply discretion. And it led to a ballad being published in the Meath Chronicle. The sharp command is speeding now to every barrack door. For Irish names on Irish carts, you'll prosecute no more. There are shouts of wild commotion from the centre to the sea and wails of consternation from the RIC. And then Douglas Hyde, who at that stage was president of Conor na Gaeilge, was objecting to these cases being defended in the courts. And he says, I left the strictest orders on the question that the question should not be opened in the law courts. I wanted the placing of the Irish forms on carts to become so common that it could not be interfered with, and the government was not interfering. To my great annoyance, this plan was knocked on the head by Pierce.
Now, Zoe, on your the list that you gave me before this, disturbing a religious service, right? Now, is that just somebody drunk at midnight mass at the back, or is this related to the, you know, the very sharp sectarian divisions that existed at the time?
The disturbing the religious service case was a case about individuals. Five men were charged with disturbing the Reverend J.W. Davison as he was administering a divine service in Bundoran in County Donegal. Again, unfortunately, that's the frustrating thing about the Petty Sessions books. They don't give a whole lot of colour to the cases as to why the act happened. But what you will find is the case will be taken against the five men, but then they will then equally take cases within. So it's almost like a little squabbling fest within the court. They will then take a case against the Reverend.
But you don't. What you're saying is you can't tell whether it's, you know, say overt sectarianism or whether it's just drunkenness or just
exactly
lousy behaviour.
It's rarely. It's drunkenness, it would be noted. So again, sometimes you can tell by what's not noted in the case. If you start kind of trying to read into these things, they will quite happily write drunkenness, assault. I mean, one of the most bizarre ones that I saw was malicious assault. I have it here, of a bicycle. I mean, how can you maliciously assault a bicycle? And that turned out to be three men, again, in Westmeath, who were obviously in an argument.
You might have Miles McGopney as the owner, you know.
So, you know, it's just, but it's if you look at the records, it's a very small sort of square, free text field, as we'd call it now, if we were filling it in online. And barely, it's you know, 20, 30 words. It's not like the court cases or the sort of legal cases where we would have large court cases that come to the more significant courts, and you have, I don't know, a huge amount of information there.
And in the book itself, Stoker provides a kind of template for each of these, how you record each of these events. And you have to have X number of columns, this is what you have to have in each column. And he doesn't want people to expand
the narrative.
He just wants it to be crisp and neat and not much detail, just in order to get the record.
And I suppose it's efficiency as well. If you think, how many cases are they processing within in one day? Again, going to back to dramatised TV series, I'm thinking of Poldark. Yeah. And you know, you can look at those cases where there are hundreds of, or 20 cases coming up in front of the JP in one day.
I wanted to ask, one of the obsessions, it seems to me, in the book is with the administration of dog licenses.
That's right.
Who's going back to dog licenses?
Yeah.
Well,
you know,
it seems to be, how important was the administration of dog licenses in these tiny courts? And he talks about getting the dog licenses at least, you know, twice or three times a week.
Yes.
And why were there so many dogs requiring
revenue?
And they're grouped together in the archives as the records of the Court of the Petty Sessions and dog licenses.
Yes.
The dog licenses will give a certain amount of information, name and address, so parish and townland of the owner of the dog, and then a description of the type of dog as well. Very, very important to a lot of people are the dog license registers.
Just to get back to the divine services for a second, There's an interesting case in the Kilrush Petty Sessions in 1913 where two inmates of a workhouse were sentenced to a month in prison for refusing to attend divine service. So that's the sort of thing that came before the Petty Sessions Court. There was a case in the Limerick City Petty Sessions where Mary Magner was sentenced to 7 days in jail for assaulting an elderly woman by hitting her on the head with an oil can. And then there was John Kelly in Ballee Sacks in the Kildare Petty Sessions was fined 2 and 6 for having no lights on his cart after sunset. He said the light went out when his cart jolted over some stones. He addressed the bench. One thing is this, ye won't be half as busy at all events when we get home rule.
Now, I notice tipping in a she bean is another one on the list. Zoe, how common was that?
That seems to have been very common as well. Illegal drinking houses seem to have been very common across the country. And you see those in all the Petty Sessions courts court cases coming up on a regular basis. Again, it seems to be groups of people who were obviously caught in the act as such. So it tends to be not an individual, but it tends to be four or five or six people up in front of the court for tippling in a shebeen.
Yeah, but this is then as part of the whole regularization of the licensed trade.
Exactly.
Because presumably it also helps catapult, you know, publicans to the very strong lobby that they are today, right? Backed up by the law. Paul, any comment on that?
Well,
that was a symbiotic relationship, if you like.
Oh, very much so. And unfortunately, like today, drunkenness and alcohol are a big factor of the courts. But I'm just looking here at a case in the City Petty Sessions in Limerick, where John Connolly was charged with being drunk, disorderly and using bad language. In his defence, he said that he went into a shop to get three-star whisky, and not getting that article, he kicked up a shindy. He was fined 20 shillings, but Sergeant McCarthy asked the judge to have him committed to jail and not give him time to pay the fine.
Now, selling cigarettes to minors.
Yeah, I mean...
No vapes, presumably.
No, but I mean, who would have thought that that would have also come up in front of the courts? And I suppose in terms of the punishments, the amount would vary depending on what the justice of the peace would thought. Repeat offenders is another thing that you will see an awful lot within the courts of the petty sessions. You'll see names coming up again and again. And if you do a search for one name, you might see, as I said with Michael Downey, multiple entrances of people coming up in front of the courts. These are, you know, they're not serious breaches, but they might lead to further ones. Again, the details can be tricky enough to find, but they are within there if you start looking.
But do you, sorry, just to recap on that, you're saying you will get reference to more serious offences. I mean, presumably they would be referred on to a higher court.
Not within the records.
Okay, so they won't appear.
They won't appear. It doesn't sort of say this is a serious offence. It's literally just that administrative piece around the courts as they happen. And I suppose, I mean, to throw out the range of things that you're seeing in front of the courts, it is everyday life coming in front of the courts.
I think as well, Zoe, when you talk about the punishments, one of the things that's striking is the variety of punishments and the way certain offences were punished. We might look at that in comparison to today. So again, going back to Limerick, Bridget Morrissey was imprisoned for a month for stealing two pairs of boots. But on the same day, James McCarthy was fined 5 shillings for assaulting his wife. So, and then Mary Neville in Glynn was... with a child in her arms, was charged with being drunk and incapable and was sent to Tralee prison for a month's hard labour. And her three children were conveyed to Listowel Workhouse. So there's, you know, there's a great variety in terms of the punishments. And I don't think you'd see that today, I have to say.
Jara, can I just come back to you? Because you referred there to Stoker wanting, you know, brevity and precision and, you know, in the reports. Why was this kind of bureaucratic efficiency and reform? Why was it important to him? What was his...
Well, I suppose he didn't... in his family itself, you look at his mother, so she was a member of the Statistical and Social Inquiry Society. So he comes from a family that's very interested in just statistics, administration, bureaucracy. It seems to come naturally to him. He just likes to have an ordered, neat office that works properly. He doesn't like chaos. He doesn't like mess. Now, that's not to say he was he didn't have fun. There's stories about how there's a delegation from the office of the Chief Secretary of Ireland sent to London for a week to lobby on behalf of some legislation. And they get drunk. They go out every single night. They get absolutely plastered. The day they're supposed to come and give their briefing to the Chief Secretary, the spokesperson is still drunk and has to be, you know, doused in cold water in order to be able to become coherent. Two of them abscond to Paris for the week instead of being in London. They turn up back in the office in Dublin with their bruises all over their faces because we were fighting. And they spent £600 in that 1 week, which is more than the salary of more, you know, two or three times the salary of them. And Stoker was very involved in that. Another time they went to a ball in Dublin Castle and they were drunk and carousing, and they formed this kind of vomit slide in the middle of the ball. Oh. When people were so drunk, they were vomiting, and Stork was off sliding down on the vomit. And when the vomit ran out, they persuaded someone else to vomit into the middle of the floor as well.
So, George, give us a little bit more detail than we need on this one.
Yes. So he was a workaholic. He was a bureaucratic reformer and an administrator by nature, but he also was a socializer, and he loved meeting all these people all over the country at the courts of petty sessions and interacting with
them. So it sounds like he could have been up before them himself.
Well, you'd wonder why they weren't for some of the, yeah. You know, that spending of £600 in 1 week, you know, why wasn't that audited properly? Particularly when his book is obsessed with making sure that the records sent back count for every single penny that's spent in the courts.
Tell you what, before we go to a break, Zoe, I want to go to you because I couldn't help but notice on the way in the various female firsts.
Yes.
Some of them, you know, scandalously recent, it has to be said, right? But the very first one on the hall there, could you talk to her, Georgina Frost?
Yeah, known as Georgie. And Georgie Frost was the first woman to hold the post of being a clerk of the Petty Session. And she was appointed in 1909. And she was from County Clare. And her father, she was the third generation to hold that post. And she had helped her father. He was the clerk of the Petty Session in County Clare. She would have helped him going around. And then she took over the post on his retirement. And that was quite, you know, 1909 is quite late, but it was quite a significant moment. And it was lovely to see that poster of Georgie coming in as we entered the building here.
Well, unfortunately, that had a somewhat unfortunate end for Georgina, because she helped her father for the last 6 years of his tenure. And then she was appointed by the local justices. But in those days, the appointment had to be ratified by the Lord Lieutenant, and he refused to do so. So it ended up...
Why? Why did he
because she was a woman.
Oh, right,
wasn't
okay.
Committed. And she took a case then to the... She took a judicial review case, which ended up before the courts in 1920. But by the time it got to court, the Gender Disqualification Act in 1919 had been passed. So she was eventually confirmed in her position, which was then abolished 3 years later when the Irish Free State set up the current courts system. So, well, Georgie.
Okay, guys, we're going to go to a break. Don't go away. Listeners, back with you after the break.
Today we have two very special guests on our program, introducing Lem and Lime.
Hello.
For Starry Lemon Lime Soda.
Thanks for having us.
What is Starry Lemon Lime Soda?
It's a crisp, clear burst of lemon lime flavor, and it's caffeine-free.
Between us, one of you must be a little more important to Starry than the other. Who is it?
We're both important.
So we could just as easily be Starry Lime Lemon Soda.
No, that doesn't sound right.
Ooh, I like it.
So you saying hip-hop could be hop-hip?
Works for me.
Starry Lemon Lime Soda. Starry hits different.
Welcome back, listeners. You're listening to Talkin' History. Tommy Graham of History Ireland in the chair. Now, Paul, I just want to go to you then, just before we finish up. How did the petty sessions develop, you know, into the district courts? You drew a parallel with that earlier.
Well, they existed in Ireland right up until until Ireland gained its independence. And following 1916 and then the 1918 general election, they began to fall into disuse, partly because the RIC by that stage had effectively become defenders of garrisons. They'd retreated to their barracks, and law and order was being administered locally by the Sinn Féin courts. So the Dáil courts were set up in 1920, and they administered justice locally. And they were notable for three things, in my view. First of all, they actively permitted women to be judges in the courts. Secondly, they were very focused on restorative justice, which has only recently become fashionable in modern-day jurisprudence. In the last sort of 10 years or so, there's been a big focus on restorative justice. It's now
what does that mean?
Restorative justice, it's where the court tries to remedy the harm rather than simply punish the offender. So, you know, if for example, somebody had something stolen, the offender would be made to pay it back, or if there was damage caused, the offender might be made to repair it. And it basically, it's now much more scientifically based, and it's now a feature, as I say, of our law. But it was wasn't really part of the traditional petty sessions type of justice. That was simply concerned with punishing offenders. So the Dáil courts say.
So that's almost like going back to the concepts of the Brehon laws, isn't it?
Yes, indeed. Yeah, that's where restorative justice practice comes from. It's a feature of many tribal legal systems the world over, and it's now, as I say, being utilised more often in the modern courts. But the Dáil courts were also they had local acceptance.
That's what I was going to ask you. What kind of inroads did they make? I mean, did the petty sessions fall into disuse completely?
They pretty well did, yeah. Now, they were only in existence really for a fairly short period of time, and it was in a context where the petty sessions and the English system of administering justice and law and order had basically fallen into disuse.
Was that over the whole country, or were there geographical variations?
Pretty well. Even in Dublin, yeah, yeah. So the Dáil courts, as I say, operated for a number of years. And then in 1924, the Free State government introduced the Courts of Justice Act 1924, which set up the modern court system, which exists to this day. We celebrated the centenary of the Courts of Justice Act only in this building very recently. And it set up the modern district court, circuit court, high court and supreme court. And then the Court of Appeal was added in 2014. And the modern day district court is effectively the successor to the petty sessions courts because it deals with the same type of cases. You will find in district courts, if you open a provincial newspaper anywhere in Ireland any week, you'll read reports of court cases in the local district court, many of which will have similar characteristics to the ones we've just been talking about: drunkenness, assaults, you know, criminal damage, allowing cattle to wander. When I arrived as the judge in Donegal, it was a complete eye-opener to me that there was such an offence still on the statute books as allowing beasts to wander, and I presided over a couple of such cases. So,
well, just going back to the Dáil courts, would Stoker's petty sessions book have any relevance for those people? Would they have taken a sneak and look at it?
I'm not sure, but I think they were pretty keen on structure and formality and record keeping. So I imagine, whether they admitted it or not, I imagine Stoker's book might have been of some assistance.
Well, there's no alternative.
You still have to organise a court. You have to make sure there's a judge, there's a registrar, cases are called and listed. So that's what Stoker's book really was about.
Now, Charlotte, this is the bit, I suspect that most of the audience have been waiting for this question. Like, what's this got to do with Dracula, right? No, that's the question, right? Has this any relevance to the style or the writing of it?
Well, it has. I always tell my students when we're reading Dracula, and they always think that Dracula is really a book about sex. I always try to convince them it's actually about secretarial skills and administration. Because if you look at Dracula, it's a series of documents that are put together. There's documents that it has diaries, you have memoranda, you have newspaper clippings, you have phonographic records, you have letters, and you have a secretary in Mina Harker, who is the main female character, who puts it all together. And she has, at the beginning of the book, she tells us she's learned shorthand, and she's kind of trained, essentially, as a secretary. And so she's adopting a kind of Stokerian attitude to all this mass of material. And that the word that's used about the material is the mass of material. And when you go to the course of the book, The Duties of the Courts of Petty Sessions, Stoker himself says, I have dealt with a mass of material and collated it and collected it. So she is kind of Bram Stoker's representative. And the key way that they defeat Dracula is through her administrative skills. She puts together all this material in a coherent and cohesive way, and they can kind of track Dracula's movements because of this. And he doesn't have the same kind of control of information that they have. So we're dealing with a kind of modernized bureaucratic system that defeats this feudal aristocrat who comes over, who just can't control the information. Although he is interested in information, we're told that he's memorized the train timetables. He has read blue books, in other words, parliamentary reports. He knows the list of peers. So he is interested in information, but he can't collate it and control it in the way that Mina Harker can, because she has secretarial and clerk, a kind of training as a clerk. And Jonathan Harker, of course, is a clerk in a solicitor's office at the start of the novel. So it's all, to me, it seems to be all about administration and bureaucracy.
And it's also about the treatment of evidence, though, of course. The
treatment of evidence. Yes.
And different points of view, different
narratives. That's right. We're given different perspectives on the same event, two or three different perspectives, and that, for the crew of Light, provides them with more information, more perspectives, more of a sense of what's actually going on and where Dracula might go next.
Yeah, and like, how innovative was the structure of the book, Stoker's book, at that time?
It was certainly, you know, you had a lot of epistolary novels and novels written as letters, but the idea of pulling together all these different kinds of material, it's very much a novel about how modernity and how communication is changing in late Victorian Britain. Victorian Britain has gone through a communication revolution with the telegraph system and the postal service being set up. A very efficient postal service, two postal deliveries a day, remember that, the penny post, and a whole system of communication in terms of the newspapers and also the railway network. So we had a transformation in communication, and Stoker is interested in this kind of modernization of information. How can you control all this mass? And what you need is a kind of a brain, an administrative brain that will bring all that material together. He was very concerned about, you know, so much information that no one has control over. You have to have somewhere to get it all in one place. And that's what you get with the duties of clerks of petty sessions, and it's what you get with Dracula.
So it's another futile attempt to try and impose rationality on chaos then.
Yes, absolutely, yes. And because it does give a sense of, as information expands, and there's more of it than ever before, there is a sense of chaos. How are you going to understand such a complicated and, you know, diffusive world? You need somewhere that, or someone, that will kind of distill this information for you. And we have something like, you know, what is a Wikipedia but an attempt to kind of distill information into one source? That's what Stoker is kind of trying to do with, first of all, the duties of clerks, but then with Dracula, where they can refer back to this one set of records. They don't have to go looking around the place for it. One set of records, and that's how we'll defeat this threat if it ever arises again.
And like, obviously, it's very global as well as its perspective. I mean, it's located in different parts of the world.
Oh yeah, so we have a Dutch scientist with Van Helsing. We have an American, Quincy Morris, who's part of this. And there's a lot of information about America in Dracula. And Stoker really did think that America, that 20th century was going to be the American century. He spent a lot of time in America in his second half of his career. And the rest of them, now the rest of the crew are all English, and they're trying to defeat this kind of feudal aristocratic authority with middle-class, bureaucratic, modern sensibilities. And that's really what the clash is.
Just before, on the whole legal angle, right, of course, the first film version of it was Nosferatu, the silent film.
That's right.
And of course, there was no permission sought or given to use the book.
And she, his widow, Stoker's widow, took the film company and their distributors to court, won the court case because they had basically used her husband's book, which was still in copyright, without her permission. And the judgment was in her favour, and all copies of Nosferatu were ordered to be destroyed. Now, luckily, somebody hid a couple maybe in the attic somewhere, but... So we would have lost that masterpiece, I suppose, had the actual order been implemented thoroughly. But she was perfectly right to have this prosecution because she needed the money as well. He didn't leave her with any money because they were fairly poor by the time he died. And she needed to generate more income. And here was this film company and director using her husband's book without permission. And she was quite happy when Hollywood came in 1932 and asked for permission and paid for the rights to use Dracula.
Now, I just watched Werner Herzog's remake of it with Klaus Kinski, you know, and it's quite faithful to the original book, actually, you know, but it's really amazing.
None of the adaptations tap into administration as a key. as a key role. Yes.
Well, the making of a movie is quite a structured business, actually, but anyway, I digress. Zoe, where can we access the Petty Session records? Where can they be studied?
So the National Archives have the original copies of them. We've hundreds of volumes between 1858 and 1924. We have all those records. They have been microfilmed. They have then been digitized and indexed, and they are available on a website called Find My Past. And that was done in a partnership program that we did with that company in the early 2000s, the mid-2000s, 2008 to 2012. You can index them, as I say, by name and find them that way. They're due to be released to us under that expiring agreement in 2027, whenever I went back and checked the records there. And that will give us the opportunity in the National Archives to do something actually more with them. I mean, it's a sizable number of names. It's 22 million names within all those records. It's a vast amount of records. But it'll be interesting to see in terms of digitization and platforming what we can potentially do with them going forward. As I say, they have been indexed, which means you can find people within them. You can't necessarily find the misdemeanors or the cases or the crimes as such or the punishments. So that's interesting. And potentially we could look to do something different in the future with them.
So no document to say from digitization by the National Archives?
No. I think the other interesting thing is not only do we have these order books, which would have been in the courts, but we also, as I said, have all the records, the administration records that sit within the CSORP collection as well, that sort of tell about the functioning of the courts.
And is the plan to have all this stuff online?
No, CSORP is vast. It's a huge collection. It sort of goes into the millions of documents. It takes over the entire third floor of the National Archives. So to actually get all of that online, it would be impossible. We have 1818 up to 1835 available in the online catalogue. The rest is all free and accessible to look if you come into the National Archives, and the staff will help you navigate the finding aids to get into those collections. And there's a wealth of material in there. It's lovely to hear Jarlath sort of say, you know, some of the facts and figures that he's found out about Stoker's role comes from that collection, and that's where you'll find that kind of information.
I just have to get a little plug in here for History Ireland. In the July-August issue, Fiona Fitzsimons' regular spot on genealogy is looking at the Petty Sessions, a short little, you know, how to use article. Okay, Paul, just to finish up, since you're the only legally qualified person on the bench here today. How would you sum up then the contribution of the Petty Session records, you know, what they tell us about the past?
Well, I think as we've heard today, and we've literally only dipped into a handful of cases, we see what conditions were like for ordinary people in Victorian Ireland. And I say much like today, you see the pathos, the humour, the sadness, in many cases, the misery, they're all laid bare in the reports of the Petty Sessions cases. It's ordinary life, ordinary everyday life, ordinary everyday people. And, you know, the human condition is imperfect, and that is always going to be reflected in the courts. And we're very fortunate that we have a record like the Petty Sessions records to tell us what was happening in Victorian Ireland.
Lisa, thanks very much, Paul. We're going to wrap it up there. I mean, this has been a fascinating discussion. I doubt if anybody in the audience ever realised it was this angle on Bram Stoker and on Dracula. So this brings us to an end to another edition of Talkin' History. I'd like to thank our panel, Judge Paul Kelly, Jared Killeen, and Zoe Reid. I'd like to thank David Slevin on sound and the rest of the News Talk team, Seifer O'Donovan, Jack Lawler, Eric Roundtree, and our producer, Marais O'Sullivan. Big shout out also to Tara Brady of the Court Service for facilitating us today. It's my first time speaking from the bench, I have to say. Also, big thank you to Joe Murphy, Tom Lawler, and Maria Schwepp of Dublin City Council's Bram Stoker Festival, and to all the volunteers who helped us out here today. So this is Tommy Graham of History Ireland signing off. Patrick will be back with you next week, and we have been Talking History. Thank you.